Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to For the Record Podcast. This is episode number 31. I'm talking in a lower NPR register voice. I'm talking like that because it is much earlier in the morning than I am accustomed to be woken up. And if you're listening to this, it's going to be live in the afternoon. and you're going to be listening to this probably around 3. Well, I'm not dictating when you're going to listen to this. This is totally up to you. But it's going live around 3 or 4 o'clock. Is the, I guess, the main point of this, but I'm very excited to premiere this particular episode. I know I say that a lot, and I genuinely am whenever I premiere an episode, because it's getting a chance to talk with someone that I would never generally get the chance to talk to in another conversation situation, and I love doing these. This one is particularly special because it's another non-music guest. I know we had Robert Eggers, the writer-director of The Witch, on a little while ago to talk about that film. But so when I started doing podcasting and when I started doing this, I wanted to do music. I wanted to do all that stuff, and I was very big into that. But one of the biggest reasons I wanted to start a podcast in the first place and what kind of inspired me to do it was I would be going on these drives up to San Francisco to cover shows, to do music photography for Shameless Promotions and Media, and do interviews, whether they were going to be podcasts or not. There was a very early version of the podcast, which was just up on a SoundCloud. It was very informal. It was, I guess it was like a beta test, I guess you could call it, if you wanted to even give it a name. I would have all this time to drive, and if I wasn't listening to a record for an artist that I was going to interview, because I generally give it a listen here, and then I'd give it a fresher listen on the way up to the city, or to Oakland or Berkeley, wherever I was going, I would download podcasts incessantly all the time. And, a lot of people know that, the Nerdist podcast was the big one for me, and Chris Hardwick and Jonah Ray, Matt Myra, that was like my gateway drug into all of this. But then I discovered Mark Maron's podcast, Greg Proop's podcast, that wide range, and all the different comedians and what they were able to do in this very interesting free medium of entertainment. And so, with that being said, I was very thrilled with this one because I got to talk to a comedian this time, which was something that I've been wanting to do for a very long time, and it's something that I'm going to continue doing. This podcast is no longer just musicians. It is filmmakers, writers, actors, comedians, musicians as well, of course. The musicians are always welcome, and they're a big part of it, but I really was looking to do something much along the lines of what a Nerdist would do, a Nerdist podcast would do, just as the basis, or what a WTF with Mark Maron would do, where you bring on a guest and you just talk to them. It doesn't matter what field of entertainment they're in. You're talking to someone and you're having a conversation. You may have talking points, you may have stuff like that, but when you do music interviews, it can be a little bit harder because I've walked into interviews before and they've been prepped until it's going to be a podcast, but they say, all right, you've got 10 minutes, and you're just kind of sitting there like, okay, so it's not going to be a long conversation, so you have to kind of get the best of it. But this episode is comedian Greg Proops, who hosts the Smartest Man in the World podcast, has been a force on shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway, both the English UK version and the American version with Drew Carey, and now the version with Aisha Tyler. Released a book within the past year called The Smartest Book in the World, which is, I guess, a spinoff of the podcast, but wonderful, wonderful book. If you have time to read, find some time to read this book. I guarantee you will love it. And you'll appreciate it. I am a firm believer that with all of the entertainment that we have, and just everything we have, I am very big on wanting to understand the roots of things and the roots of not only music, but film and literature and all those different areas of entertainment that we enjoy so much. They all came from somewhere. They all started from somewhere. And this is a good, this book is a great curator for all of that and to get you started. Because let's face it, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of movies and books and albums out there. And so when someone says, oh, I want to go and look at the classics, I want to go and look at back at some of the greats, it's overwhelming. You don't know where to go. So it's always good to have a place to start and someone to curate that. And Greg does an amazing job of doing that with this book. And as well with this podcast, with the different things that he talks about on the show. He was really nice and invited me out to his podcast last night at the San Jose Improv, where he did a 3-night stand, and it was so much fun. It was really great. Greg, again, thank you so much for everything. I truly appreciate it, and it was wonderful to talk to you, and I'm very excited for everybody to hear this one. So we met up in downtown San Jose, right near where he was staying. We got coffee and iced tea, and we just talked. I had some questions, I had some ideas and things like that, and it was wonderful. It was really great. So let's just jump right into this then. I'm very excited to unveil, For the Record, episode number 31 with Mr. Greg Proops.
Exactly. And then they're kind of like, oh, it's a conversation. Okay, that's cool. And then they're surprised at the end of it. And I'm like, because they're very used to getting asked the, if you could be an animal, what animal would you be?
Same five questions.
Yeah, by the, like, the.
Who are your musical influences?
Who are my musical influences?
No, I was joking.
Oh, okay.
Just being a bad rock journalist.
Well, that's pretty much, it's like, that's the same, they get asked the same five questions, and I try to mix it up. I listen to all the records and read any information I can find, and I do my research, but I definitely have to say, so we're here with Greg Proops in San Jose, California, and one of the things I did want to talk about was when I was going through comedians and people that I wanted to talk to, I didn't just go through and pick random ones. I did grow up listening to your comedy and watching Whose Line and things like that. So I was like, oh, this would be cool. And so I thought it was perfect that you were coming to San Jose. So
yes.
Yeah.
Fortuosity, as they say.
Exactly.
Serendipity.
Exactly. So I have like little talking points here and stuff like
that.
But, I guess, so I read Smartest Book in the World and loved it.
How kind of you.
I want to do my, and you made a thing. I want to purchase and help you.
Thank you. It's very nice of you.
It was fantastic. I loved it, and I am going to, over the next however long it takes me, I'm going to go through and watch the movies and listen to the music and all that stuff.
Oh, gee whiz.
I'm huge into soaking up all of that information and all of that knowledge. I love it. But one of my biggest questions after finishing the book is, where did your thirst for knowledge come from? Like, just your the ability to just kind of want and know information.
Well, you know, I think just from being a longtime fan of movies and sports and books and history and everything, the one thing my parents never denied me, aside from, of course, intense abuse, was any books I wanted, they'd always get for me. And when I was little, it was the, we didn't have, if I'd had a computer when I was little, we would have gone crazy, but because then I could have watched the movies over and over again
exactly.
I loved. You know, instead we had to go and see them or wait for them to come on TV. But there was these Time Life books, you know, And there was books on nature and books on history, books on this, books on that. And my grandfather sent them to me, and my parents bought them for me, and they bought me an set of encyclopedias when I was a little kid, and I would just sit down and read the encyclopedia. Like, I didn't know you weren't supposed to just read it. I thought, you know, like, here's volume M. Let's just dig like, in here, you know.
Let's go. All right.
And so I think I'm just sort of naturally nosy and curious. And then I married Jennifer, and she's... possibly the most dogged and thorough researcher that I've ever met in my life. She doesn't let a topic go. And I've been calling her Robert Redford the last couple of weeks on the podcast because she's like all the president's men. Like this whole thing with Antonin Scalia's death, you know.
Yeah.
And now we found that he was attending a hunting party at this obscure...
Yeah.
With the Order of St. Hubertus, which was established in the 1600s and then... a modern branch in the 60s here, and like she just won't let it go, you know. She's a tenacious. So I happen to marry someone who is even more at a certain point I'm like, let's just get high and, you know, lay on the couch. I don't have that much ambition, which we try to do as often as humanly possible. She'll have researched everywhere to go, art museums, historical sites, and I just kind of go along for the ride because she's so tremendous about being thorough. Of course, when she's not there and I'm in charge, when I'm with my friends, I fill her role. People say to me, well, what should we do? Where should we go? And of course, I just call her or text her.
Yeah,
and then she tells me what to do. So I think that's part of it is that. And then the luck of like, you know, I can't even remember how it happened at CineFamily a couple years ago. I went to do somebody's, maybe Doug Benson's interruption or something, and started talking to the cats who ran the place. And then they were like, well, why don't you show a film? And I'm like, all right, I'll show a film.
Yeah.
And then so now, like 3 years later, we're still showing films. And now I've been able to show them in Scotland. And we did the TCM Film Festival last year.
Oh, yeah.
And we're hoping to do it again this year. We'll see.
Fantastic.
And last month we showed, or last week rather, we showed... oh my God, I'm blanking on it. We showed it 2 days ago.
Let's see. Because I think
we're showing Times of Harvey Milk in a week's time. That I remember.
Yeah.
We just showed
a
hilarious comedy, and it was because we showed two Preston Sturges in a row, and then we went back and.
For the when was it?
About a week ago.
Bullet.
No, Bullet we showed in Edinburgh. Well, in any case, it'll come to me. That I have giant holes in my memory, as you can see.
No worries. This
happened 4 days ago, and I can't remember it.
No worries. I'm the same way.
But I can tell you what we're going to show next week, which is Times of Harvey Milk. And then, the film club added to the book as well, because I put almost all the films we showed in the film club in the book, and some other ones that I liked. And, you know, the foreign films, definitely Jennifer's strength.
Yeah.
And... that's a long answer, but I think that's why. I mean, my parents wouldn't go anywhere and they wouldn't do anything. I thought they were stodgy, you know. And then I never really got to travel when I was in high school. I was stuck in my suburb. So as soon as I became a comedian and I could get out and get around, it seemed like the thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
And so I started late, but I've tried to make up for it by being vociferous.
Where in the Bay Area did you grow up? Because I knew that, and I
San Carlos, the little white suburb in between Redwood City and Belmont.
All right, fair enough.
Sort of stifling in its homogeneity in those days. We had, this is the 70s, there's probably 20,000 people, 21,000 people.
Yeah.
And very white. I mean, there was like four black kids at our school.
Yeah.
And then they bussed in a bunch of kids from East Palo Alto, which in those days was known also as Nairobi. And I'm not saying it in a diminishing way.
Yeah.
They called it the people who lived there, the inhabitants called it Nairobi. And so all of a sudden there were 400 black kids at our school, at a very white school on top of a hill. And then we had riots. That happened for a while. And the cops came, and then skinheads came to foment bullshit. So it was a little education as growing up in this little white town.
Yeah.
My lab partner was a black girl who I think thought I was the biggest idiot of all time, you know. And she was tall and gorgeous and wore a giant fork in her hair, you know, a natural fork.
Yeah.
And then we'd play music in class and I'd sing along to the Spinners or something and she'd look at me and just be like, oh, Lord, you know, what is with the 5 foot tall white guy with the glasses? Because I always loved soul music, you know, it's a big thing with me. And So that's where I grew up. So when I had the chance to, as soon as we got wheels and we were able to go to San Francisco, we started going there immediately. And down here, we saw, I've come down here and see concerts too, saw AC/DC in San Jose.
Oh, fantastic. 1978. I saw them, not them, but yeah. I saw them in 2008, I think, is when they came back on like a
fantastic.
They were so good.
Yeah, they're astounding. And yeah. The Tubes down here.
Cool.
And but mostly San Francisco because, and then, you know, I had gay friends, and so they split San Carlos and moved to the city, so then I had somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And hang out with them and take drugs and, you know, the whole enchilada. So the freedom and romance of San Francisco was far too much for me, and I couldn't wait to fuck off from San Carlos. So as soon as my parents left me, basically, which was nice of them, and I moved in, I moved to San Francisco State with my pal, Forrest, and then that was that. You know, I met Jennifer there, and I never wanted to ever go back.
Yeah.
Some people have nostalgia for their hometowns. I don't hate San Carlos. I don't think it's an awful place.
Yeah.
And I don't think the people were even particularly racist or narrow-minded. They were just suburban white people, nice middle-class white people.
Yeah.
We lived in an apartment there because I'm not exactly... I aspire to be middle class. We were a little more lower middle class, perhaps blue collar. My mother was a waitress and ran the apartment building, and my father was sort of a degenerate gambler.
All right, fair enough.
Not a lot of ambition coming out of there.
Fair
so
enough.
That was why they didn't. And he was from New York, which I was like, why don't we ever go back to New York? And he like, no, I'm not going back to New York.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to New York till I was, I don't know, 28, 29. So there you are.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, no, I...
I attended the College of San Mateo as well for 2 years.
Fair enough. No, I was going to say, talking about the nostalgia thing, like, I totally know what you mean with that, because it's like, it's when you're accustomed to a place for so long, it's... You have a special place for it, but you see these other things, and you're like, fuck, I want to go there. I want to see this. I want to...
Are you from San Jose?
I am from San Jose. I've been here my entire life, and...
Did you go to San Jose State?
I went to Santa Clara University.
Oh, okay.
So I within the same.
Is that a Bronco?
Broncos, yes. Yes. So I went there and I graduated last year. So
nice.
I finished up and I've just been working on this, and I did a couple jobs in PR, like in tech PR and things like that, just because it was my field was in communications, but I was actually gonna bring this up. I had an emphasis in cinema studies, so I studied films and things like that. My teachers were very adamant about the classics and different things like that. Even though they would not explore it as much, they said, watch Citizen Kane and you're good. And I'm like, there's got to be more to that than this. And I mean, it was a great film. It was absolutely a great film. But
I didn't put it in the book.
Yeah, I was... Well, I feel like you wrote something about, like, a little blurb about it, like how it's always mentioned.
I maintain that Casablanca is the great American film, not Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And Jim Norton, who's a critic from the 80s, wrote that Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is the great American film.
Okay.
Not Citizen Kane. I think Citizen Kane's a superb film.
Mm-hmm.
It could be funnier.
Yeah.
It's not very funny.
No, it's not.
And it's not romantic either, so I think it falls down in those two areas. I mean, not that it's trying to be. It's not trying to be funny or romantic, but it's a bit grim, I think, to be the greatest American
story,
film.
Yeah, it's about the downfall of somebody and it, like their rise and then just their complete fall.
Right.
And
he's a loveless, mean, grasping, horrible, controlling.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and that was one of the things that I wanted
tycoon.
To
tycoon.
Yeah. Exactly. So close to Donald Trump, no, I'm kidding.
Right, but without the personality. Oh, not sure, he stands for office, he runs for Senate.
And less orange.
What does he say, mommy, is daddy senator? Not yet. Not yet, dear. I love that scene.
I gotta go back and rewatch that movie.
That's my favorite shot in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
There's so many, that's a movie of movie making. I think that's why critics love it so much. It's a movie about a movie.
Yeah.
Every shot in it is set up so hard, and there's no casual shots in it.
Everything's pinpointed.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's when he's running for election and he's still thin and he's not old yet. And he's standing at the lectern and it's like a Leni Riefenstahl movie. They've got him way up there and behind him it says Kane.
Yes.
And him, and it's a giant picture of him, and he's standing in front of a picture of himself, and he's haranguing the crowd.
Yeah.
And they pull back, and you see everybody screaming like a Nazi rally.
Yeah.
And that's when they pull over to the box, and the son says to the mom, "Is Daddy senator yet?" And she goes, "Not yet, dear." She couldn't be more bored.
Yeah.
Just couldn't be more bored.
There, I think my favorite shot. I think my favorite shot in that film is when, after all of the, I forget what, probably like 3/4 of the way through the film. When the snow globe drops, and then if I'm trying to remember, he then the camera turns back, and then you see it, and it just slowly pans up on him, and this look of realization goes over his face, because he's remembering, like, it's his only attachment back to what was his younger
before life. He was a tainted.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know. I just thought that was always brilliant because it was weird because it was almost one of those scenes where when you go into college for 4 years, what I had noticed, because I was not thrilled to go into college at all. I was like, I want to tour and be a musician, and then I realized 4 later, so I'm kind of glad I went to college. But I kept getting caught up in all these ideas and all these different things about music and writing, and I felt like I almost became this different person. And then when I saw that, it's kind of like, shit, is that my realization of like what just happened in my life? So,
right. Did it all go past
yes.
me? I also love this shot where he goes to the opera and his friend has to write the, Jedediah has to write the, and he's drunk and he doesn't want to write it because he hated it. And all you see is the word typed out, weak. That's the review. And then he sits down and finishes it, but you see weak.
Yeah.
Well, Greg Toland is that whole movie, isn't he? Yes. I mean, the camera work in it. I mean, I don't think Orson Welles is without talent. I just think he had an amazing ability for self-promotion that is actually more impressive than his talent as a filmmaker.
I could agree.
And to say that he made this one great movie and then the Hollywood fucked him over and he wasn't able to do it again, it's a little simplistic in my opinion.
For sure.
If you're a great filmmaker, you're going to find a way to make another great film.
Oh, exactly.
And he didn't. I mean, he made a couple of really good films and parts of others that are okay.
Yeah.
And he's an okay actor. He's a bit hammy. He can overdo it. I liked him when I was little. I always loved him because he was so hammy.
Yes. Well, it was weird. It was very weird because like that was my first introduction into classic films, and I've always wanted to watch more, which is why I was so happy when I read that book. And it was like, okay, here's a place where to start. Here's where I can go with this. Because they'd shown most of Casablanca in our classes and things like that. But there's like, but other movies that were listed, I think like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, different, just all that whole scope. I was just very interested. So I was
looking
at that and I'm just like, yes, okay, cool. I have a place to start.
So you can totally tell which ones are mine and which ones are Jennifer's, you know. Eyes Without a Face and 400 Blows, those are Jennifer's.
Yeah.
Mine are Butch Cassidy, Men Would Be King. She'd have never put that in.
Yeah.
And so that's why we do the film club together, and I let her choose pretty much all of the films
because
her taste is so unassailable. And we only have 2 criterion for the film club. One, is it awesome beyond measure? And 2, is it under 2 hours? Because it's a chatty show and people's butts go to sleep, and I'm aware of the time constraint. And if I'm going to rattle for 30 minutes and then 10 minutes at the end, I can't have a 2.5-hour movie.
Yeah.
I can't show Lawrence of Arabia. I can't show Tarkovsky's The Sacrifice. I can't show Che by Soderbergh. You know, it's too long. So movies that work best are punchy, punchy screwball stuff or 70s crime, because they all kind of run in about 100 minutes.
Yeah.
110.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe that one of the problems with Hollywood filmmaking now is simply that you go to see a mainstream Hollywood movie and it's 2 hours and 25 minutes long.
Yep.
And you're like, I actually don't need that much entertainment.
Yeah.
Cut me down to 120 and I'm good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to get out of here. I can't drink that much Coca-Cola.
Exactly. And that's how they get you.
Yeah.
They get you to come back at like, what was the, there was some movie that I went to go see recently and I was like, all right, I'll take a small little thing of popcorn. That'll be $7.75.
Mm-hmm. $7.75, man.
And then it just goes
for the small.
For the small, and then
$5 for Coke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they hand you the small, and it's like
doing?
The size of a bucket, which I think is always ridiculous.
Right. Sideways. That's what we just showed.
Mm.
We showed the Alexander Payne movie Sideways.
Okay.
Which is hysterically funny.
Was that the one with?
It's Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church, and they go on a weekend together,
yes.
a week together to blow it out before he gets married.
Yes.
And all Thomas Hayden Church wants to do is get laid, and all Paul Giamatti wants to do is get drunk.
Yeah.
And so they're completely banging heads the whole thing. And so he has an affair with Sandra Oh and tells her that he loves her, and then she finds out he's getting married because Paul Giamatti accidentally tells her best friend. And that's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah.
She gets up with this helmet, and you see it from behind. He brilliantly shoots it from behind.
Yeah.
You don't see him get hit. You just see her swing that helmet.
Yeah.
And you know what a helmet's like hitting someone's nose.
Oh, easily, yeah.
And he just goes down, and she just bangs on him for an hour and goes, "You said you love me," and then she goes, "You fuckface," and then turns to Paul Giamatti and goes, "You too." And he goes, "Me? Like,
what
how is he to blame?"
Yeah,
yeah, how
exactly.
is he to blame? You fuckface. You too.
No, that was another one that was on my list as well, because I had the book, and then I had this, I forget, I think I'd printed it off when I was still in school. It was like somebody made an IMDb list of the, like, it was like 1,000 movies you must watch or something, and so they had the greats, they had the classics, and then they had some that were like culturally relevant at the time, so I naturally crossed off all the Twilight ones because I don't need to see any of that.
No, they're not very good either. No. They're not very well made.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, I'm chuffed to death they're made by women, you know, that they're women director.
Yeah.
I think that's significant, but
yeah.
They're, you know, they're schlocky.
Yeah.
They're schlocky monster movies.
Exactly. It's to cash in. It's always... It's like they're made within a year of each other.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They're produced as quickly as they can possibly be made.
I did a Doug Loves Movies and Michael Sheen was in it. And Michael Sheen's in one of them. And he said that they were shooting a scene and he thought it was going to be out on location in the snow. So he opted with the costumer to do this giant outfit with boots and a cape and a cloak and a
yeah.
jublet and a hat and a scarf and a sash and a thing. And he goes, "We get in there and we're on set." And he goes, "I never stopped sweating. I was never more comfortable in my life." He goes, "I was about..." And then they'd put smoke in and steam and stuff. He's like, "My eyes started to..." He was like, "I made such the worst choice. I should have gone for like a bikini or whatever." Like, he goes, "I thought it was in the snow. I didn't realize they're going to CGI everything."
Yeah.
Which
and
the that
other
made
thing,
me laugh.
You can tell everything, like, I did see the ending sequence to... the final one where it was like the giant battle or something like that. They had this
right, where the werewolves fight the
yeah.
vampires.
And then
whatever.
It's a fucking dream. And that's
right.
the whole thing. And I was
what
just...
What a ripoff.
Yeah, everybody was sitting in the theater and I swear that I heard a girl, because I'd walked in and I saw like the ending scene and I heard a girl yell, "Are you kidding me?" or something
yeah.
like that. And I was just like, "Oh my God."
Right? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Well, I think... I was talking to Scott McGee of Turner Classic Movies about this, and the very thing about choosing films. And of course, there's so many films, and there's loads of worthy films. But what people require is a curator. It's not so much that I'm so smart or I know anything more about film than anyone else. It's simply that if someone tells you, "Watch these 10 movies and here's why."
Yeah.
That gives you a guidepost to go and watch those movies.
Of
and if
course.
You trust the person. So like if you watch Turner Classic Movies, they show all these old movies. And he said, "This is where we start." He goes, "I've got 2,500 films in my house." And I go, "Me too." And he goes, "But if I start thinking about which one do I want to watch tonight, I'll never pick one."
Yes.
I'll walk up and down and look at all of them.
Yeah.
And then
that's what
he
I
goes,
do too.
"But if you turn on the TV and there's Citizen Kane or there's whatever,"
yeah.
"you'll go, I'm going to sit down and watch this one."
Yeah.
And then it's been chosen for you.
Yes.
And he goes, "So what we do as a station is curate. We're curating old movies."
Yeah.
"So that you go, oh, there's a Bette Davis movie on tonight. Or, oh, there's a pirate movie on tonight. God damn it, I want to see that pirate
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Or I don't want to see that."
Yes.
"But tomorrow when they're showing this movie..." And I thought, that's exactly the purpose of my podcast, the purpose of the book. Some people really huffed off about the book and they're like, "It's not really a book, it's just a list of stuff he likes." And it's like, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
Getting to know
it's
you and by
list.
What you like.
Right.
Exactly.
But there were people who like were angry, like, I thought it was
yeah.
going to be like a novel or whatever. I'm like, it's not a novel, it's books. And I tell everybody, books I like, records I like, films I like, pieces of history I like, baseball I
yeah.
like. That's what it is. It's not, I didn't try to write like the definitive, you know, concordance of the Western culture or anything.
No,
like.
Exactly. No, people get pissed about everything.
I know.
People get irritated about everything.
We live in a reactive world.
Oh, we absolutely do. Like, it's ridiculous. What
everyone's offended by everything,
yes.
and everyone's angry about everything.
Yes. And then when you give them okay, here's what you wanted, they will find another reason to get angry about
it. If I did that, then they'd say I'd be... A British guy asked me a couple years ago about the podcast, and he said, oh, you've got catchphrases now, because we do.
Yeah.
And I said, honey, I've done comedy for 30 years. I said, I've earned it.
Yeah.
If the audience jumps in and yells wild boars or they yell Jeremy Irons or whatever, you know what? I never cultivated that. It all happened organically. Everything that happened on the podcast, I never calculated. I never thought, oh, we're going to have kittens, or oh, we're going to have Jeremy Irons, or oh, we're going to have wild boars. I thought of it on the moment, or someone yelled it out. Yeah. I didn't even provide half the... All those baseball teams that are in the book, that wasn't my idea. The audience thought of that. Someone got up and went, if you were going to have an all-time Roman Emperor's baseball team, who would it be? So I had to address it. And then that blew up into...
Yeah.
The tedium of having every single baseball team ever made up. And people still write me all the time. This week they wanted countries, bands, and something else. But I've stopped doing it because it got too...
Yeah.
After 3 years, it was too much.
There's too much, and there's so much ground.
But it's organic. Love that he was like, oh, you got catchphrases now. It's like, hey, I'm not on a sitcom. These are organic.
Yes.
Jeremy Irons came out of... I was reading something, and I went, here's an impression I can do. I'll do it as Jeremy Irons. And then people are like, oh, my God, we love it when you do Jeremy Irons. So you may have noticed, if you listen, I haven't done it much lately.
Yeah.
I've given it a rest for a year. But yeah. You don't have to do it. Once you establish things, years can go by, and people still think you do it all the time, and it doesn't... There was a cornball radio show in the 30s called Fibber McGee and Molly.
Yeah.
And the big running gag on the show was... McGee's closet. Like, he had this closet that he never cleaned. And every year or two on the show, they'd go to the closet. It was a radio show, so he'd go, don't open the door, and he'd open the door, and everything would fall out. And evidently, that running gag... But people's recollection of it was it happened all the time.
Yeah.
But the writers of the show were like, once a year, maybe. You couldn't... You know, you could beat the gag to death.
Exactly,
But everybody thought you did it all the time.
Exactly.
So if I don't do Jeremy Irons all the time, people still go... I've had 20 texts this week about Jeremy Irons reading Lolita, Jeremy Irons doing, you know, like, and the kittens thing was just so I wouldn't swear as much, but of course I swear anyway. And I was on a kid's show called True Jackson.
I was going to ask you about that.
And one of the lines they kept giving me on the show is kittens. And then my wife and I had already said McTavish, so I just started saying kittens and McTavish on the show. And then we found out this cardboard cat that appears in the show, which I carry with me, sadly. And then the stickers came off the back of it. And then people just like it. It's like they like kittens. So I didn't sit down and go, what can I do that'll really sell kittens? It just sort of happened. So.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at the same time, that's where the best, in my opinion, that's where I think the best comedy comes from. It's when it's organic, when it's something that is, you can see that it's not fabricated, and it's not just like, okay, how do I do this? Okay, this will be funny. It's just, it's something that comes of your...
Yeah.
Yeah, just basically, yeah.
Well, we like to riff, and...
Yeah, exactly.
Oop. It's the first plane that's gone over.
Let me see. That's not too bad.
So what were you going to ask me? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine.
I never shut up.
I was going to ask you about the True Jackson role, because I noticed that, and I've always very curious, how do those roles, I mean, as a comedian who's going in comedy clubs, doing podcasting, things like that, how does, I guess with more family shows and things like that, how does that come about, essentially?
Well, I had a different agent then, and he sent me out on this, I was doing a chat show at Largo at the time.
Okay.
And the chat show I never really put out. There's a little couple little clippy videos. I taped it a lot. We did one in the podcast with Tony Visconti and Mark Crowley and Lipsinka that we did 2 years ago in New York. And then when David Bowie passed, Tony Visconti was David's producer, so I put it out again.
Cool.
I double dipped on that one because it was a chance to talk to Tony about working with T-Rex and David Bowie.
Of course.
And he's such a... Oh, my God.
Whoa.
This is fantastic.
Wow.
This is so elaborate.
That's a first. I've never seen a horse down here.
No.
There's an Indian wedding that's going on right now, so that's why we're...
And a bedecked horse is just ridden by, and a woman carrying an enormous parasol.
Oh, my goodness.
And you can hear them all yelling. I assume they're going to put the bride up on there.
I would say, yeah, I'd figure it'd be the bride.
I might have to get a picture of this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
this
go for it.
This is too much.
Go for it.
Really too much. I haven't seen this... I went to a wedding in Morocco by accident with my wife. And
how did you go to a wedding by accident?
Well, we went to this cultural center to see, like, this display of vases and whatnot. and a wedding broke out, and it was a traditional Berber wedding, and in those they carry the bride and groom on a bier, right? So the groomsmen and the bride's ladies, so they were in full traditional garb, you know, and they were just carried over the crowd, and there was this whole insanity. And,
oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was really wild.
Oh, man.
And now this, a horse has appeared, basically we're next to a hotel in San Jose here, in a mall, kind of. Yeah, it's fantastic. And there was a lot of excitement. Well, anyways, they gave me the audition for the show, and it was right after the writer's strike, so the two cats who were producing the show, Andy Gordon and Dan Kobelman, were big-time TV producers and are back on regular sitcoms. And I read my little part, and I was playing a fashion designer, so I really loved it, and I went in, and I wore a suit and tie and my glasses and lots of hair, and I thought the part was really cute because he hires a 15-year-old to be the vice president of the company, and that's what the scene was. And so I read the scene, and I put it on tape. Then they gave me a call back, and then I was in Cleveland, Ohio. And they were like, they need you to come back in. And I said, I can't come back in Cleveland. And so I went down and put it on tape again for a casting agent named Christian Bullock. And my manager was no help at all, it has to be said. He's like, well, I don't think they're going to pick you off the tape. And they picked me off the tape. And so I remember having lunch with the producer, or with the guys who were making the show when we were at the commissary. And I said, can I ask you something? I never auditioned for you live. I never met you till we got to the set. And he went, oh, no, it was always you.
That's awesome.
Because I have that quality. I'm effeminate and articulate, and I seem like I would be a designer, I think. And then they named the character Max Madigan, and they gave him a girlfriend. So I said to the producers, will you explain to me how he's a designer in New York and he's not gay or Jewish?
What'd they say?
They just laughed. Oh, so I'm like, how do you have an Irish straight guy as a designer in New York? It doesn't happen. That was 7 years ago now. It seems like yesterday to me. All of the kids on it, of course, are big time. Matt Shively's on sitcom called Meet the... Oh, golly, I can't think of the name. There's billboards all over L.A. for it. Robbie Amell is on Flash, and Kiki just did the live Grease.
Grease, and she did Scream Queens as well.
And she's in Scream Queens. I just wrote Kiki. And Ashley is on a lot of ABC Family stuff. And, they're all tremendously talented and lovely young people. Yeah. I don't really see that... You know, when show business isn't... You don't get to hang out too much, so... And they're all in their 20s, too, and I'm old, so why would they want to hang out with me?
Well, I just remember when I was in, because that show 7 years ago, I was in high school still, like, Whose Line, and like that was my go-to, because that was where I'd known you from, and I was like, oh, that's awesome. So
the kids knew me from it on the show, but it was hilarious what their frame of reference was for stuff. If I could do Jack Nicholson for them and they'd laugh, but if I did Jerry Lewis, they had no idea what I was doing. The crew would laugh. Like, so they knew Michael Caine because he was Alfred, the butler.
Yeah.
And they knew Jack Nicholson, and I don't know why they knew Jack Nicholson.
Probably that.
But they didn't know Jurassic Park. Well, they're young. You have to remember. This was 7 years ago when they were 15, so.
I knew Jurassic Park when I was a kid.
Well, they didn't. I remember I would do Richard Attenborough jokes, and they would be like, what the hell are you doing?
Spared no expense.
Yep. And so it was, but they, on the other hand, they are enormously talented. I'm proud of them. I have no reason to. I mean, I'm not their dad or anything, but it was great. The thing that I enjoyed most about doing the show was the health insurance. But the other thing I enjoyed was we played live in front of kids every week. We recorded in front of a live audience, and you can't bullshit kids. They only laugh if they find it funny. They don't laugh out of courtesy or because they think the line's clever. They don't give a shit if the line's clever. So we did a lot of slapstick on the show and pratfalls. There was horses, mice, snakes. I had to have snakes all over me. I was pulled in a harness. I was tossed off a building. I was lifted in a chair by a balloon. Like, we had to do Nickelodeon stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I really enjoyed that part. We had a stunt man that taught us how to fight and roll and everything. And so that part was fun for me because I would come in as big and broad as humanly possible. And the kids never stopped giving me shit. And I could see them cabaling in the corner, conferring, Kiki and Ashley. And then Kiki'd come over and go, what was Abraham Lincoln like? And I'd go, fuck you, that's what he was like. And I taught them all my jokes, which they didn't know because they were kids.
Yeah.
And they thought they're so funny. What'd you have for lunch today? Cancer, you know. And like, they and don't say fuck in front of the KIDS.
Yeah.
And it was a really fun atmosphere because everybody had a great sense of humor. Everybody's a... All the people I've mentioned, and Ronnie Butler and Danielle Basuti, the other two people on the show, really great comedians. Like, it was cast to death, it really was. And I thought it was well done by the producers to put me in it, because why not have a comedian play the father figure type, or boss?
Yeah.
So I was really not an authority figure, I was just a kook, which I really appreciated.
Fantastic.
And I did Gail Gordon, Charles Nelson Reilly, Hal Peary. There's a million character actors. I made a list when the show started and wrote it down in my room of all my favorite TV character actors, and I would do them as Mr. Madigan.
Nice.
So that was my guidepost. Like, people go, like, how do you center on the character? It was like every great sitcom from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Because there's so many great character actors that come in and go, into a scene, and it's like, that's what I'm going to do.
I'm
going to do it like that. And that'll be the element that the kids... will think is new.
Yeah.
They don't know what a 70s sitcom was like.
Of course.
They don't know who Mr. Roper was.
Yeah. I know the name. I still know the name. And so that was, doing the film program that I'd done, that was another thing that they talked about and emphasized a lot, is exploring, like, those kinds of sitcoms and those older television shows. So that was always a big thing, because if you look at a lot of sitcoms now, it's not, it's not amazing.
Well, and Funny Neighbors, and I mean, it used to be imperative that there was an older, crazy person on almost everything, and I don't think that's as imperative
anymore. That's not
the
case anymore, no. I think Life in Pieces, it's on CBS or something, I think Colin Hanks, that one has done it, because they have, like, I think there was a scene where, in the first trailer for it, the whole family is gathering in a church, like it's a funeral. And then the grandfather gets up. He's like, "Thank you all for attending my funeral today." Or
right.
Like
right.
That. So it's like.
Well, they tried it with the Shatner one, right? The shit my dad says.
Yes.
Right? They tried to throw in the crazy dad, you know.
Yeah.
Who you can't control and all
yes.
that.
Yes, I remember Shit My Dad, and it went off so quickly, which made me sad. Shatner.
Well, the other funny thing about True Jackson was, Whose Line has been on off and on for 25 years,
yes.
right? We're really on to like our millionth year, and this is our fourth year on the CW this year, and. Other than that, I've never been on any successful TV shows.
Seriously?
True Jackson ran for 2 years, and that's the longest. Every other show I've done that I was ever on TV lasted one season.
Seriously? What other shows?
Versus was a game show I did. I did a show on Discovery Channel called Mind Games. I did a show on a syndicated program, a dating show, when everybody had a dating show. Mine was called... Rendezvous.
Okay.
And all of them lasted one season. And I made a million pilots of different game shows, this, that, and nothing.
Oh, man.
But Whose Line, and then True Jackson ran 2 years, so I thought, wow. I had a job for two whole years.
Whose Line has always been, like, at least, and not just for me, but for many people, many of the friends that I grew up with, even though we shouldn't have been watching it as a kid, like, at all, even if it was on ABC, and it was, because it's always kind of been that one show that was always there for us, and it's always been there. And then we got older, and then found out they released the first season uncensored, and we're like, oh shit, we gotta watch this, and it was, like, the greatest night of our life.
Did you watch the English one, too, at all?
I watched a little bit of the English one. It was whenever it was on Comedy Central.
Right.
Was when they would run it, and then my parents would go... Why are you watching Comedy Central? Whose Line? They'd watch it, and then South Park or something would come on, and they'd tell them to shut up.
Right, and then you got squashed.
And it's like, all right.
Too much adult content.
But yeah, I did watch the English one for a little bit. But the ABC, Drew Carey, that is, like, that was the, and still is, whenever it is on. And then the Aisha Tyler one that's on now. Was that, I guess my question about that one is, were you guys, I mean, was there a general excitement when that was announced, that it's like, it's coming back? Is it?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in a group with Ryan on our 18th year now.
Wow.
And so we've been working together whether or not that was on.
Yeah.
And and in various configurations with Colin, Brad, everybody. I've done gigs with all of them over the years. And of course, all the English cast, because I sit in with them when I'm in England. I'm sitting in March with the Comedy Store Players, which
cool.
is Josie Richard, Lee, all them, Paul. And we were surprised that Dan was able to sell it to them again. But, I mean, Dan called me, the producer, and said it's going back on.
Nice.
So he actually told me, so I knew. It wasn't that big a surprise. And that we're going to have a new host. And that was the biggest thing. And Drew didn't want to. I don't know if Drew wanted to do it or not, but he's already on Price is Right. So
that was the big thing that I remember hearing about.
Yeah, it's great that we're back on because it keeps us sort of out there. Hilariously, I don't think that many people know that it's on the CW. People come up to me all the time and go, "Don't you miss being on the show?" And I'm like, "No, I don't miss it because I'm still on it." And then, "Do you miss doing Whose Line?" No, because like I just did 2 weeks with Ryan on the road.
Yeah.
The last 2 weeks of my life, I was on the road with Ryan, so I was like...
For sure.
And then I'm going to see all the English cast again in 2 weeks' time, so, like, I can't miss it.
Yeah.
I can't shake them, for goodness sakes.
I guess with that, I think it's important to have a show like Whose Line in terms of comedy because, like, as much as I love stand-up and things like that, improv is a totally... I mean, this goes without saying, it's a totally different ballgame, and it's just... It's very... It's just fun to watch because it's... It's improv. It's all on the spot. It's all right there. It's, I don't know, it was a completely foreign concept to me when I was growing up and when that, not only that show, but when there were other improv groups around town, it was just very different and very fun to watch. And I always thought
that's
it was,
nice to hear.
Yeah, I thought it was very important to be able to support stuff like that because it was just unique to me, so.
Well, it is different than just a sitcom or a stand-up show, so, and I also think that I'd like to think that we're responsible for launching a million improv groups around the country. I think they're going to start banging on drums in a minute here.
Oh, yeah? I think so. Let me see if it's picking up.
I was going to say, we might have to wrap this up here.
Yeah. We're almost at about an hour, which is perfect timing.
Okay.
So they're going to do that. I guess the last thing we can close on, the other thing I did want to ask you about... the podcast is when you were coming up with that format, is it better, which do you like better, the live format or just the version of just sitting in the studio and just kind of talking and riffing on a mic?
I like it live because I want that feedback and I want that immediate reaction from the audience, and I think it keeps me more honest. Even though I can be a self-indulgent bag of, you know, effluvium, having the audience there makes you be funny. The studio gives you another feel, and it's a way, the extemporaneousness is different for me. Knowing that there's a crowd there and that I can get laughs out of them makes me try a million times harder to be creative. And then people will write me, and we've done, what, 6, 7 studio ones in 5 years?
Yeah.
And they'll go, "I really love those ones you do in the studio." And I'm like, that's damning me with faint praise because there's 250 episodes live and there's 7 that are in the corpus.
Which, of course, goes back to the whole thing. People will always find something to complain about no matter what. Which brings it back full circle. Greg Proops, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Jared.
Yeah.